Moncrief on News Talk.
Although we value money, it doesn't have any intrinsic value. It's made from paper or metal, or increasingly it's just a set of numbers on your bank statement. Jacob Goldstein is the author of Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. And he joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Jacob.
Hi, good afternoon.
What did people do before money?
Oh, great question. So before money, you know, people lived largely in really small sort of tribal cultures, right? A small kind of kinship. Everybody knew each other. And there were lots of rules in those cultures, we think, about sort of giving and getting. Rules say if you wanted to marry somebody was a big one. You know, you often had to give their family some number of, say, cattle. Actually, if you murdered somebody, that was also one that was typically a rule. They had to give their family something, cattle, cowrie shells, little bronze bracelets. And that seems to be the real origins of kind of money before money.
Right. Okay. So, but obviously those things had an intrinsic value already. When, as far as is known, did somebody first come up with the idea with, well, this other thing, it's not intrinsically as valuable as a cow, but it's equivalent to a cow?
Well, that's an interesting question. And it kind of depends on how you define intrinsically valuable, right? I mean, by one measure, if you take, say, gold or silver to be intrinsically valuable, with a few brief exceptions, we didn't really depart from that until the 20th century, right? We were on for almost the entire time, not quite always, but almost the entire time, on a gold or silver standard, essentially. And paper money, say, or bank deposits were ultimately redeemable for gold or silver until the 20th century.
Right. But is it fair to say the Chinese were the first to come up with a system of using currency?
So the Chinese invented paper money, which is a great story, actually. So, you know, by the time this happened, it was around 1000 AD. People had been using coins for more than 1000 years, for about 1600 years. And, you know, coins, the value of coins was based ultimately on the metal they contained, right? So in Europe, in the West, people were using gold and silver. In most of China, people were using bronze. But there was this one province in China, Sichuan, where largely they were using iron coins because they didn't have that much bronze. And iron is not very valuable, right? So the coins weren't very valuable. So you needed a ton of iron coins to buy anything. You needed like a pound and a half of iron coins to buy a pound of salt, which is terrible, right? Like, I don't know, do you guys have pennies in Ireland? I think of it in the States as like having to go grocery shopping with pennies. We still have the penny. Crazy. So this merchant, some merchant in the capital of Sichuan has this idea. He says to people, look, you leave your iron coins with me, and I'll give you a piece of paper that's like a receipt. And whenever you want, you can bring the paper back and get your iron coins back. And people start using the paper to buy stuff. And it's a great idea. It's like this revolutionary technology. Everybody loves it. The government gets involved, starts printing essentially the first paper money.
Did it last in China?
Well, it lasted for a while. So that's a great question. So, you know, you have all of these profound changes. You have so that's about 1000 AD that happens. And it spreads throughout China and actually helps to fuel this sort of proto-industrial revolution in China. You know, there's more trade, there's urbanization, there's technological change, largely, or at least in some part, because money makes it easier to move value around, right? You don't have to schlep giant carts full of coins, you know, around this pre-industrial country. So they love paper money. It lasts for hundreds of years. The Mongols actually invade, and they love paper money. They start using paper money, you know, all across Asia. And in fact, there is a moment then when they try and have paper money backed by nothing, and that works for a while. But ultimately, this new dynasty comes in, the Ming dynasty comes in, and they don't like money. They're kind of the way people maybe are wary of like big bankers today, or, you know, the city of London or Wall Street. And they sort of love what their ideal setting is, the agricultural village and self-sufficiently. And the Ming dynasty ends up getting rid of paper money around 1400. So like 400 years, long time.
Yeah.
Paper money is this amazing thing. And then they get rid of it and it disappears from the face of the earth for hundreds of years. Like no more paper money anywhere.
And the Mongols, when the Mongols adopted paper money, is it true that if somebody didn't accept paper money, they'd have their head chopped off?
Yes. Use it or I'll kill you was their basic monetary policy.
Okay.
And, you know, we know this from multiple sources. The one we're most familiar with in the West is Marco Polo, you know, the famous Italian traveler who visited China during this time. And when he came back and wrote his book and described how, you know, I think he said something like how the great Khan causeth the bark of trees to be used as money or something to that effect. people thought he was making it up. People in Europe were like, there is no way that is true. But it was true.
Yeah. Now, and as you say, paper money disappeared for a long time. And in Sweden, they did use coins, but the coins were 2 foot wide.
Yeah. So it's sort of similar to the Sichuan iron story. In Sweden, they apparently had a lot of copper. And so rather than using silver or gold, they used copper for coins. Same problem. Copper is not that valuable. So they wound up making these, you know, quote unquote coins. Is it really a coin if it's several feet long? They weighed like 30 pounds, you know. And remember, there's no trains, there's no cars. So people would carry them like strapped to their backs. So perhaps it's not surprising that that is actually the first place in Europe that we see paper money is Sweden. When in the 1600s, they're like, tell you what, we're going to create this bank that is actually the predecessor of what is today the Central Bank of Sweden. And same thing as in China. You leave your terrible iron coins here and we'll give you some paper. And people are like, that is a great idea.
Now, and during the same century, the French also adopted paper money. Though I understand that that was because of a Scotsman.
Yes, yes. An amazing story. A bit later. So 1600s was Sweden. The Scotsman, his name was John Law. He was born in the 1600s. And he, you know, this is a really, really interesting time in history, the history of money especially. It's this moment in Western Europe when you're seeing like the origins of modern financial capitalism, right? You have joint stock companies that are like kind of the first multinational corporations that people can buy and sell stock in. You have paper money. You have banks becoming kind of more sophisticated. And so there's this Scotsman named John Law. He moves as a young man to London and is this sort of man about town, gambling and chasing women. And he gets into a duel, as I guess one did then, and he kills the guy he's dueling, and he gets arrested and convicted of murder and sentenced to death. And then he escapes from prison and gets on a boat and travels around Europe and gets rich as a gambler and sees all of these financial things happening, sees corporations and paper money and banks, and just has this vision of like creating an economy and starts pitching it, you know, the way maybe a startup founder would be pitching venture capitalists today. John Law is pitching whatever duke or, you know, prince he can get his hands on. And he finds a taker in France. The Louis, I think it was 15th, one of the Louis, is a little boy at this time, like a five-year-old king. France is being run by this regent, the Duke of Orléans. And the regent loves John Law, loves his ideas, also loves to party. So they, you know, drink together, talk ideas. And the regent just gives John Law all this power. So John Law creates the first modern bank in France, the first paper money in France. He gets control of France's North American territories, which is like half of North America along the Mississippi River, names the capital, this little proto capital for his benefactor, the Duke of Orleans, right? That's New Orleans. That's how we get New Orleans. Mm. And then there is this incredible boom. France had been basically bankrupt from like fighting perpetual wars as they did then. And having a bank and paper money and a company is actually good for France's economy for a while. And then, as will happen with booms, as we all remember, as you certainly remember, and we remember the States, you remember in Ireland, booms can get out of hand. And this happens in France. And so the stock, so he has stock in this trading company for North America, the Mississippi Company, they call it. It goes into this amazing bubble. Prices going up and up. People are coming from all over Europe to trade this stock. They invent the word millionaire because so many people are getting so rich, they need a new word for it. And then it all comes crashing down. There's too much money and too much stock trading, and there's a huge crash, and they chase John Law out of Paris, and he lives the rest of his days in Venice as a gambler collecting art, which sounds not so bad.
Yeah, really, it is fascinating the way history repeats itself, and the one thing we learn from history is that we learn nothing from history. In the United States, is it true that at one point there was something like there were thousands of different sorts of paper money?
Yes, like 8,000, which is still hard for me to believe. I wrote a book about it. I still sort of don't believe it, but it's true. So what happened was in the United States, and this is like 1830s, 40s, 50s, right? First half of the 19th century. There was no central bank. The government at that time didn't control money the way governments control money now. As I said earlier, you know, paper money is still sort of a claim on gold. And so at that moment in the US, the way the rules work was basically anybody who wanted to could set up a bank, and your bank could print its own paper money. Hmm. And so, of course, if the rule says anybody who wants to can print money, lots of people are going to want to print money, right? So there are all these banks, and each one has different money. Like, you know, some banks, like if it's a bank in a whaling town, they'll put a whaling ship on the money. Some banks would put Santa Claus on the money. All these different kinds of paper money, which is, of course, a nightmare if you're just a person running a store or a bar or something, right? And so there were actually special like magazines, basically periodicals that, if you're old enough to remember the phone book, I kind of think of them like a phone book, right? They would have a listing of every kind of money. So if somebody walks into your whatever pub and gives you a, you know, a $2 bill with a picture of Santa Claus on it from some bank you've never heard of, you would look up the bank in your little book and it would say what a $2 bill from this bank is supposed to look like. And it would say, yeah, there's Santa Claus on it. So you would take the money.
Were the changes in the use of money, they tend to be gradual. Or, you know, did someone, was it a bit like Bitcoin, I suppose, is what I'm thinking of. Did somebody like invent a new way of doing money and then everyone goes, oh, that's a good idea? Or was it more to do with the circumstances at the time?
Well, you know, it's kind of like, what did Fitzgerald say about going broke very slowly and then all of a sudden? Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the time somebody would have an idea and it would kind of kick around. One thing that happens a lot is there's a crisis. And the crisis forces some big change. I mean, maybe the most striking one is the Great Depression forcing the world off the gold standard, right? The gold standard was this, you know, the center of sort of economic thought and monetary kind of systems for the whole world. And, you know, coming into the 20th century, it was kind of the center of this first era of globalization. And then the Depression hits and, you know, one thing all kind of right-thinking people can agree on is whatever happens, we shouldn't go off the gold standard. We have to stay on the gold standard. But in fact, the gold standard was dragging everybody down. You know, what the world needed at that moment was more money, more actual money, so that, you know, prices would stop falling, interest rates would go back up, banks would stop collapsing. And you can't do that on the gold standard, basically. And so sort of unwillingly, in some cases, countries went off the gold standard, and it turned out that that made the Great Depression start to get better. So that's maybe the most striking case of a really sudden, really profound shift caused by this great crisis.
Do you think Bitcoin is the way of the future?
No, I guess would be the shortest answer. It's interesting. Bitcoin is really interesting, and it's a really clever technology. You know, one interesting thing about Bitcoin at this point, it's been around for a long time, right? It's been around for a long time in technological terms, not in monetary terms, but it's been around for like 12 years now, which is what, about as long as, say, Facebook or the iPhone, more or less. And if you think of how ubiquitous those things are, it's striking to me, there's this pair of facts that I don't quite know what to make of. One, people are willing to trade a tremendous amount of dollars or euros or pounds for Bitcoins. But on the other hand, nobody really does anything with Bitcoins, right? The dream of the people who invented Bitcoin was not that it would be really valuable and you could get rich by buying it early. It was that people would actually use it to buy stuff and it would undermine government control of money. And that has obviously not happened. I think because government control of money works pretty well. So maybe if there were some profound, profound crisis of government-issued money, that might be Bitcoin's moment. But I hope that doesn't happen, because that would be terrible, right? That would mean a tremendous amount of human suffering.
But also cash, and it's interesting, you know, at the moment we're in history because of the pandemic. Certainly in Ireland, no one's using cash. The few shops that are open would prefer you to pay contactless with your card, so no one's paying cash anymore. And I suppose a lot of people might be thinking it's not making that much of a difference to my life. Could cash itself be on the way out?
Yeah, cash, it's much easier to imagine cash disappearing than to imagine Bitcoin becoming the, you know, the money we use. Largely because even before the pandemic, the vast majority of money in the world was not cash. You know, even when we close our eyes and think money, we probably think of a picture of a bill, of a note, you know. But, you know, if you think of the money you have, certainly the money I have, almost none of it is in paper money. Maybe I have, you know, $100 in my wallet or something, but I, you know, have $1,000 in my checking account, say, or more if I'm lucky on a good day. And so the vast, vast majority of money in the world is, and long has been, just numbers on a bank's computer, right? Like, it's not like the bank has stacks of paper money. Like, it's not like for every dollar you have in your checking account or for every euro you have in your checking account, the bank has a euro in the vault, right? Yeah. That doesn't exist. It's just numbers on a ledger. So, yeah, I mean, you know, there are two main worries when you think about cash going away. One is privacy, which is basically why they invented Bitcoin, because in a no cash world, every transaction is trackable, right? So if you are worried about that, that's a worry. And then the other one is there are people, I don't know how it is in Ireland, frankly. In the US, there is a strikingly large number of people without bank accounts, right? And if cash goes away and you don't have a bank account, you're basically screwed and you're in this kind of high fee world. So that's the other problem. But yeah, I could definitely imagine cash going away.
Yeah. One of our listeners wants to know your opinion on the euro. Was it a mistake? Which is a debate which still rages to this day in Europe.
Yeah. Wow. That is a big question. It certainly has not gone as well as people hoped, right? I think one interesting thing, and, you know, here is the tension, I think, at root, to be a little reductive. It's very hard to have one kind of money and be many different countries, right? Mm. And so I think the elites who were pushing the euro always sort of had in their mind that the countries sharing the euro would become more like a single country, right? But I think they didn't really want to say that because people would have been like, wait, we don't want to be the same country, right? The Germans would have said, we don't want to be the same country as Greece. We want to be a different country than Greece, to take a, you know, striking example. But when you see the things that have happened, even in the past year, I mean, as I said, crises often force things forward, right? And so just in the past year, there has been this new kind of commitment from sort of Eurozone-wide commitment to have more shared lending and even grants, right? What is the phrase? The common something? I forget the phrase. But there's this program now where the Eurozone as a whole is basically giving money to some of its members because of the crisis and, you know, having joint taxes. And that kind of shift, right, toward a unified fiscal authority, basically, right? Not just printing money, but also taxing and spending. Like, you basically need to have a unified taxing and spending authority alongside the unified money. So I guess that's the long-term question for Europe is how much is it willing to be like one country?
Yeah, it's a mixed thing. Jacob, fascinating to speak with you. Thanks very much for doing that today. Jacob's book is called Money, The True Story of a Made-Up Thing. We're going to take a break after that, picking up the pills.
Moncrief on News Talk.